the unfolding there, or unraveling of what we understand knowledge workers in front of computers to be, is going to be tremendous, and not something that I think the majority of the public or business or Congress is really in connection with. And that, to me, is something I might like to get involved in to help people understand it, because it's coming.
Today we have a special guest who embodies creativity, wit, and a perfect blend of humility and humour. Meet Simon Berg, a creative entrepreneur and an AI aficionado obsessed with the power of creativity. Simon is the driving force behind Seros, an AI-powered content platform revolutionizing how marketers, designers, and brands create interactive digital experiences. Under Simon's visionary leadership, Seros has empowered hundreds of thousands of users and gained over 1,000 customers, including industry giants like Red Bull, Condé Nast, and Universal. Originally from Essex, UK, Simon boldly moved to the US in 2012 to embark on an incredible Seros adventure. With over $100 million in funding from VCs and notable business leaders like Mark Cuban, Mark Andreessen, and Ben Horowitz, Simon's mission is clear: to unlock creativity through liberating technology. As we unravel the magic behind Seros and how AI is transforming the creative landscape, Simon also opens up about the emotional rollercoaster of being a CEO, the highs and lows, and the unique challenges of leading a cutting-edge company. So sit back, relax. This is one episode you won't want to miss.
Simon, it's so great to have you on the show today. You are the founder of Seros, an all-in-one AI-powered platform to create, edit, and publish interactive designs, among so many other accomplishments. You've lived a life with this belief of creativity matters that has helped fuel a lot of your drive through multiple projects. Take us back. I happen to know you personally, and I know that there's a story when you were a young boy where that creativity matters mantra sort of stuck with you. Can you take us back there and provide a sort of a timeline and evolution of how you became the Simon of today, somebody that's a strong leader and somebody that values creativity?
So, yeah, no, thank you, Simon. I appreciate you having me on, and it's very, very nice to be here, and it's good to get to talk about my history. And, you know, I've told you this before, Simon, because you and I, as you say, known each other for quite a while. When I was a very young boy, my parents and my life was kind of complicated. And I always say that I faced my own form of adversity and constraint. And the adversity was really my parents, who were not great at providing the comfort that young children needed. They were good parents in their own right, but they fought a lot, not physically, just emotionally, and a lot of yelling and shouting. And somewhere in amongst all of that, I found myself sort of seeing that as an adversity at some level. And the constraint for me was the academic system, because I'm not your traditional academically minded human. I think very differently. It's funny, actually, I find that the way large language models work feels closer to the way my brain works than what they taught me in school. And I just wasn't really well suited to the academic world. And when you put those two things together, you know, you had the adversity of the parents yelling and screaming and not really doing a great job of raising a 5, 6, 7, 8 year old boy. I had a brother who's older than me, but you put that together with the academic system really just not being in any way or shape or form really viable for me. What ended up happening was I kind of found this freedom, this spirit. And what I think happened to me is what I think needs to happen in the world, which is that I found my love of curiosity and creativity in the world. And I would go out and be curious, like kids do, you know, grabbing bits of cardboard and making spaceships out of them or building tree houses. But that love of that curiosity and creative thought stayed with me beyond my childhood, because it was literally the way I coped as a kid. And most people get it drummed out of them by parenting or by the academic system, and don't need to hang on to it, because it isn't necessarily their coping mechanism. But for me, it was a coping mechanism, which meant I kept it. And I'm still the same to this day. If I feel sad or I'm down or I'm bored or I'm frustrated, it's a soothing mechanism. I will go and build something. I did it today. I've literally been in the garden doing a whole bunch of stuff for my kids, and you don't need to know the details. But that's what I've been doing today, because I feel a little anxious because of what's just happened in my career. I'm anxious. So what do? I go and create and build, and then I feel safe again. So that's where it came from.
Totally. So just a little bit about the Saros angle. That was a move into the digital world. What's the quick summary of that and building a company? I remember seeing some photographs of just a few people sitting around a table in a bar, and then that ballooned over the years to hundreds of individuals. So how do you think that creativity spirit helped propel that mission and get people on board?
Yeah, I mean, I think as part of that whole me piece that I just rambled on about, there's always been this thing where I like to inspire other people to be creative, and I like other people to inspire me. So I like to work collaboratively. I don't get much more joy than that, really, when I'm creating something with other people. And I think when, you know, I grew up as a young boy, I left school at 16, 17 and went to work in a business that was owned by three people, one of which was my dad. And it was kind of weird because three bosses, my dad wasn't really a silver spoon in the mouth kind of guy. I stayed in that company for 17 years, starting as a tea and coffee boy and getting turned upside down and put in trash cans and such. And as I came out the other side and, ended up doing every job in the organization possible, I ended up being the joint managing director with one of the partners. My father had retired by then. And then I became CEO. And Saros was born out of me ultimately being the CEO of that company for 5 years and building software products inside the agency, which is not uncommon. And one of them was Saros. Saros was a magazine page-turning technology in Flash back in the day, 15 years ago. Right? And when I sold that agency, because we ended up selling that agency to a private equity firm, which is also complete. I mean, was new to me at the time. I'd never done anything at that scale ever, but I managed to bullshit my way through as I have in life. And we got to the other end, and I did a year with the PE firm, got pretty frustrated with them, if I'm honest, watching them sort of torture the baby that I'd created, which is a bit sad. And eventually I said, I want to get out of this, guys. How can we negotiate a way for me to get out? And can I take Saros with me? And they said yes. And I had about four people in Saros at that point. Flew to New York City because the incoming CEO that was coming in to take over from me in the agency that we sold, a guy called Dilip, said to me over lunch once, he said, you're a leader, not a follower, Simon, and you're never going to work for me. So the fact that you want to move on makes sense. You should go to New York because you're born to be there. The way you're wired you're meant to be around people that inspire you and want you to do more rather than the sort of the negative English, which can be a bit. And before I knew it, I was on a plane, I pitched Greycraft, and the rest sort of is history. And now I live in America with two kids and a wife
So what would you say, were some of the leadership lessons that you learned along the way in terms of inspiring others with that creativity matters messaging?
I think, as a leader, as a CEO, I am eternally living with the imposter syndrome. As far as I'm concerned, I am a bullshit artist and I don't belong here. I've been making it up ever since I was 16 years of age. It's just a complete scam. And it doesn't matter what I do, it doesn't matter what I do. Somewhere in the back of my head, I feel like I'm a fraud and I don't belong here. I don't know how that will ever go away or why it's there, but it's always been there. And it's really weird because I will contemporaneously, sometimes within the space of minutes, believe that wholeheartedly. I'll be like, I'm an absolute fraud. I don't belong here. And then within a second, I'll be commanding the room and thinking, I know exactly what I'm doing. I'm the man. And it's like, how does those two things exist? And I think, Simon, that's probably why I've done pretty well as a leader, because that humility and confidence contemporaneously existing, I think, is quite likable. I think people like it because it's like strength, confident person, but also kind of humble and very vulnerable. And I've cried on town halls. I've cried in front of my execs. Not obviously, you can't do it every day, but when the moment is right and it's an undeniable moment where you're overwhelmed or it's too much, or, we lost the round of funding that we so desperately needed 7 years ago. and you get on with the execs, or you sit in the meeting room with the execs and you say, you stare at them, and what you feel is, it's too much, I can't take it, and you cry. People like that. But then in the same breath, when you do that, when you do have an idea and you feel really confident about it, people really believe you because they're like, seen you cry when you're scared. So if you're confident, you must believe it. I don't know. Somewhere in that stuff is probably where it all comes from, I think. I don't know.
And I know that you like to use the term wearing your chicken suit. And then I think that's partly what you're explaining there. So how would you say that could encourage other people to also be vulnerable when they see their leader being open to that emotion? What do you think that helps get the best qualities out of people when they feel
it? There's no doubt about it, Simon. There's no doubt about it whatsoever. There is no doubt, because at the end of the day, it is absolutely, life is ridiculous. Like, it's ridiculous. We are a bunch of ants on a rock floating around in space with no fucking clue why we're here. And we busy ourselves every day with the things that we do, our meeting that we're having now and the job that I just resigned from, or like, we busy ourselves with that stuff every day. But in truth, it's a joke, really. The whole thing is just a game. It really is just a game. And I think all we really have is the moment that we're in, right? And our love and connection with other human beings. Really, that's all you have. And if those experiences that you have are present and real and authentic and, I don't know, connected and stuff, if you pile all that together as a leader, people want to be around that. In my experience, people want to be around that. Customers have wanted to be around it for us, and team members have wanted to be around it, and I want to be around it. Like, the thing I'm missing the most, and for the audience that's listening, I just resigned from my own founded company after 15 years. The thing I miss the most is that. I miss the connection. I miss my chief design officer, Jack. I feel emotional thinking about it. I miss him. I miss the conversations. I miss the ideas. I miss all of that stuff. But the problem is, and the reason that I resigned, was because that energy was only what I did 20% of the time in the end. 80% of the time I was doing stuff I didn't like. Not bad stuff. I'm not judging it. I'm just saying it didn't serve me. It didn't fill me up. It didn't make me happy. I'm not afraid of hard work. I'll work 14 hours on something I love a day in a row, 7 days in a straight. But when it doesn't fill you up and you don't love it, I think you go away. And I think that, Simon, is what I miss, and what I think people around me enjoyed, and what I enjoyed getting from them, was that feeling of just making stuff with humility and fun and enjoyment. It's just good. I'm sure the agency you guys have built is, you know, I'm sure Playing Co's got a lot of that. It looks like it from the site. It looks like it from the images of the team. You enjoy what you do.
Yeah. I mean, everything you're saying, listening to you, I'm like, how the hell am I going to ask you any questions? Because it's like you're reaching inside my mind and just pulling out thoughts that I didn't know were there.
Well, yeah, exactly. Especially the whole thing about sort of, you know, being a CEO or just the founder of something and saying you feel like a fraud. Like, I feel like I totally understand that. Like, there's days where I'm like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I don't know if I'm doing this right. You know, maybe it's the way society builds the sort of the pedestal of what you should be if you are at the realm.
The myth.
Yeah, the myth of being the company owner.
The myth of founder and CEO.
I honestly think everyone feels the same way that you did. And it's just...
Yeah. And
they don't say it. That's the problem.
No, they don't say it.
They think, oh, if you say I'm scared or I don't know, people think, oh, and I've said this, I actually said this to one of my investors once. People think if you say I don't know or I'm scared or I'm overwhelmed, and I admit you can't say that every day, who's going to follow that? But on a day when you inherently and undeniably have no fucking clue what you're doing or you're overwhelmed, if you say that with, you know, authenticity and real emotion, and you let it out, and then the next day or a week later you feel like you've really cracked the rubric and you know what to do, they're going to believe you 100
times
more.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
It's equity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because anybody that pretends they always have the answers and are never scared, everyone that interacts with them just discounts it because they're like, you're human. You're clearly fucking flawed.
They're robots. Yeah.
And they're usually wearing polyester suits and double-breasted and silk ties and slicked hair. And you can spot them from a mile away.
We'd like to take a moment to remind you that Play & Conversations is brought to you by Play & Co. If you want to explore more about design opportunities, discover new insights, or connect with Play & Co. for a design project, be sure to visit playandco.com.
Yeah, no, I think everything you're getting back to what I was saying, everything you're saying, I can only imagine is an order of magnitudes greater than what we experience. With a team of eight people, Karen and I, there's not a day goes by where we just check in with each other and say, hey, and we're a husband and wife team. So it's maybe double the dynamic. But we're like, is Jason still having fun? Is Simon still having fun? Are they feeling fulfilled? Are they going to leave? Fuck, what do we do? That was actually going to be one of my questions back to you. I think Simon hinted at this thing about how do you lead? Any lessons or experiences about, going back to that, round of beers at the table when you were eight people deep, and then how do you get people to follow? To follow your vision. Is it just being authentic? Is it just about everything you've just explained? Is there some, it's never, and this is the other thing, it's never totally perfect, right? There's no one silver bullet.
I don't even know if there's a straight answer to it, really. What flashes into my mind is back to imposter syndrome. It's like, I don't know. I just am myself, and that sort of ongoing being myself thing. I know people that have known me in group therapy, my therapist. I know people that have worked with me on boards. I know the people that have worked with me in executive teams. I know that people have seen me in town halls. I know people that have gone out and socialized with me. And some people have almost done all of those things with me. And the one thing that always comes back is they always say to me, "You're the same wherever you are. Like, you're no different." And I'm like, yeah, why the fuck would I want to have six personalities that I have to train to hang around with me? It makes zero fucking sense. Like, why would you do that? And they're like, well, just society says you should be more formal in a board meeting. I'm like, why the fuck would I do that? That doesn't make any sense at all. Like, I am who I am. And if you don't like it, then you can go away. And who I am, I think, is a pretty okay guy that tries to do nice things in the world and wants to build companies. And sure, I'd like to make some money so I don't have to wipe my own bum when I'm fucking 90. But really, I'm just trying to do something in the world. And that's that bloody thing from WeWork. He ruined it to make the world. Oh, yeah. He ruined it, the arsehole. But because the truth is, that's what drives me. God, I can nearly barely get it out. I looked at my LinkedIn from the post when I resigned. I can't believe it said 40,000 views. I just cannot believe that that's how many views it's got. Like 300 comments. And almost every one of those comments, I cried. My wife cried. She came in and she's got tears in her eyes. People saying time after time, "You've impacted our lives. You've made my life better. I wouldn't be who I am if it wasn't for you." And I'm messaging back saying, "We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. And I wouldn't be who I am if it wasn't for that lesson you taught me." And that chemistry is something, like, what else is it? What's the fucking point of being on the planet? So I can have loads of money and a big pile and just point at it. Like, what's the point?
I just, every time you bring up an analogy, an image comes into my mind, and that one was Scrooge McDuck.
Yeah.
Right? Like, sitting on his gold coins.
What is the fucking point? It makes no sense. And I think, that is the gift. The gift of people saying things to me and me being able to say to them that you've impacted me in this way, or you taught me that, or like you inspired me on that.
Yeah.
And otherwise, what's the point? If not trying to make the world better than when you found it, when you were brought into it, that is what we're supposed to do as far as I can tell. So I try to make it better, even if just making it better means 400 people when we were at our largest, their lives are a little bit better because I taught them a thing or two that I knew and gave them a place to feel like they were part of something bigger than themselves. I made the world a bit better than when I found it. That'll do.
Yeah. Yeah, you give 400 people a sense of purpose and drive around a mission, even if it's only for a few years of their life. Yeah. And the lessons that they can take forward and you know, that footprint or that impression that you put onto them that they can then carry on to their other roles, like Simon's doing with us at Play & Co.
Yeah, I mean, Simon was impacted by layoffs, for God's sake. I mean, I had to look him in the eye, a guy I really, really like he's a friend of mine, and he was impacted by layoffs back in the day. And we did incredible creative work together, Simon and I. We created a publishing brand inside a software company with, you know, one of the best editorial people in the business, as far as I'm concerned, a guy called Mark Healy. And we made great stories. We made people laugh. I don't know. It seemed like it was a good use of time. It seems better than counting beans.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll back that up and say that my experience at Cerros was a magical experience, and it's what I'll always cherish. And that brings to mind, you know, one thing I've noticed about your leadership and your curiosity and all of this, Simon, is you're very good, even if you don't think it, behind the curtains, at adapting to change. And one example of this was during the pandemic. You were a force to hold on to in terms of leadership, and there was a lot of uncertainty. You had a very strict stance that nobody was going to be let go during that time. And I think it really provided this harbor of light to a lot of people when they needed it. So can you talk a little bit more about your ability to adapt to change and how this creativity matters spirit sort of ignites that force behind you in terms of creative new directions when you come to a fork in the road, and how might that be happening right now as you're looking to a new horizon?
Well, there's a lot to unpack now. Firstly, very kind words, Simon, both in terms of how you feel that your time was at Cerros, but also the way you characterize the COVID period of the Cerros history. It is really kind, and it's humbling, and it hits me again. It's like, oh, I don't deserve it. But also in my head, I'm like, yeah, I did a good job, actually. I did a really good job. There's like both of those feelings exist in my head. It's really weird. But if I lean on the what did we get right or where did it come from, I know that it was, to me, and this is sort of looking back, it wasn't clear to me at the time, but to me, what I found the most, and this is actually, it will dovetail into what I want to do next. What happened in COVID was all the people, because I'm not a billionaire, I'm not in a position where I can fund my own, obviously I'm not a billionaire, I said that like as if anyone thought I was. I mean, I'm not a billionaire, I'm not rich enough to fund my own experiments and explorations of the world. So I've always raised money to do what I want to do, which means there's always the watchers, the judges, you know? Mm. They're always around judging. And that arcs back to my mother, you know, bless her, she's a simple soul, but she used to judge me a bit for her own insecurities when I was a kid, when I was creative. So I'm really triggered by it. Like, it really destroys my soul when I feel judged. And knowing that the investors are always there looming impacts my creative abilities, because you don't want to, if you're a kid out in the garden playing, making stuff out of cardboard, and someone looking over the fence and going, what are you doing? How much cardboard are you using? Why are you using that cardboard? Put that down. What's the plan? What are you going to use it for? You know, what are the KPIs? How will you know if it's a good rocket ship? Like, fuck that. Like, it's not going to work, right? And as a human, as a leader, I struggle really badly with that presence in the background. But I've learned to cope with it. In COVID, what happened, and this is only something I've realized looking back, they had no playbook to judge me against. There wasn't a playbook. What is it? Where? In what chapter of the McKinsey playbook does it say how to handle a global pandemic, economic unrest, civil disruption, the craziest president on the planet? I mean, the list goes on. Like, there is no playbook, right? There was no playbook, which meant I found myself in board meetings with people that didn't know what to do, that owned the company and funded it, suddenly saying nothing and just going, you know what? If you know what to do, we'll follow you, Si. If you have a plan, go for it. You do whatever you want with no judgment. The world is imploding. We don't know what to do. I came alive in that moment. It felt like I was meant for it. I never felt more happy and clear because no one was judging me. It was just, I feel tingles now thinking about it. It just felt like the universe was speaking through me. It was like, you go and do that thing now. I don't even know. It felt very comfortable, very natural and very unjudged. And it was a beautiful time that I'll never forget.
It almost feels like a 180 or a 360 back to when you started as a kid, you know, escaping the home. You were talking about, you know, not really fitting in at school, spending a lot of time on your own, curiosity, creativity, going out in the garden, just figuring shit out on your own. And COVID kind of gave you this bubble where the world went silent for, I don't know how long it went silent for in the US, but it felt like it went silent here for about 3 years. And that gave, there was no, to your point, no playbook. So you just had that space again. Yeah, and
it was oddly magical. And obviously it was a difficult time. We went through a lot of trouble. Economically, there were issues. Of course, there were lives lost. Terrible things.
Yeah.
But in amongst that chaos was this weird feeling of it just all, life was simple. It was a lot easier. And like you say, no judgment, no playbook. It was just, sure, if you have a plan, go. And I did. And we started writing, Simon remembers these, Mark Healy, the gentleman I was speaking about, who was the VP of content, ex-editor-in-chief of a couple of big magazines. He and I started on a note we called Creativity in Captivity. And I wrote one on the 17th of March, I think was the first one, on a Monday. I think it was 17th of March. And I wrote 100 more every single week. And I'm not a writer. I mean, I am now. I'm better than I was. I wrote one every single Monday. And they were full of hope and introspection. And I mean, one of them, I accidentally smoked a weed pen that I thought was a CBD pen. And then I canceled the town hall for the next week. I told the truth in the email. It was fucking hysterical. I was like, guys, I've got to confess, I canceled the town hall because I was high as a kite. And actually, that was the investor. That was what the investor rang me about. He said, you can't do that. And I said, why not? And he said, they'll think that you've gone off the rails. I went, no. They'll think that I'm a real human being.
We felt the same kind of. I've had a similar experience, at least creatively, when COVID hit. When all lockdown measures came into place, and the world was suddenly looking austere. We were like, "Oh, what the hell's going to be handed to us?" But I found what happened. Particularly in the US, I think this was a very much a US-centric thing. And I mean, I love Australia, but I use this analogy. When COVID came, you know, it was a wall. And the American mindset was, okay, so here's a wall. How do we get around it? How do we blast through it? How do we jump over it? How do we dig under it? How do we helicopter over it? In Australia, the mindset was a little bit like, here's a wall. Let's just sit and wait until the wall falls down. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like we got tremendous amount of creative work and exciting projects from companies trying to pivot, you know, companies in the consumer electronics space pivoting to like rapid diagnostics and saying, we need to get these prototypes out, you know, within a month, and super exciting work. So I felt like you, like there was just this energy around just getting on with it, particularly in the creative space. So that was good to hear.
Just to switch gears a little bit here, Simon, you've always been at the forefront of what's happening in terms of creativity, technology, and the intersection between the two. Obviously, AI is the new thing, and something I know personally that you've spent a lot of time researching, in fact, developing your own products around. What are your thoughts, you know, as you embark on this new chapter, and where do you think things are going, and where do you find yourself slotting into that, if that's something that you feel like doing?
Yeah, I mean, I've always considered myself to be a blend of art and science as a human being. And I think both are creative practices, right? One being, you know, have a hypothesis, control a bunch of stuff, test some things, conclude, test, write it down, conclusion, make new thing. The other one being, I don't know, I like blue. Blue's good. Green is good. Yellow's good. Do you like the blue and the green and the yellow? Tall, small. I like small. You like small. And that's kind of the two ends of the spectrum. They both manifest new things in the world. But I'm an art and science guy. I'm a bit of both. I can play in both arenas. I'm probably two parts art, one part science. But I think AI is truly right in the middle between the two. I think it's odd because it's been manifested by the scientists, the logic called sort of engineering types. And yet what they've accidentally done is they sort of gone, let me run a very scientific experiment. And then this blob of creative shit fell out the bottom and they went, oh, it's a random machine that does things, but it's random. And the scientists are all like, what the fuck is this thing? What do we do with it? And I feel like that is one of the areas that is really interesting to me, because I think those that understand the technology when it comes to AI and understand how it's been built and what it really means aren't really artistic. They're not comfortable with the chaos of AI. And if you understand it, it's probabilistic, not deterministic. And science is a deterministic thing, right? It's like you set out the rules. It's all very rule-based, like traditional coding. If this, then that. Mm-hmm. What's happening with AI is random. It's literally random math that generates things that are useful. And I think the artists of this world, the true creatives that really want to get their hands on it, don't understand the tech. And I, as a human being, find myself sort of in the middle. So I would like to spend more time on it, to your point, Simon. As to how I will be doing stuff in that space, I don't know. And as to the other question you asked, because it was a threaded question, I think, where is the world going to be in 2 years? I think it's very hard when you understand the magnitude of the change and the pace at which it is changing. It is very difficult to truly predict where we will be 2 years from now. And I think anybody that has a strong prediction of where we're going to be or purports to have a strong prediction of where we're going to be in 2 years is naive. Actually, I don't think they understand what's happening.
Or it's McKinsey.
Well, isn't it the same thing? I shouldn't say that. They're a customer. Oops. Fuck you, McKinsey. You're the best. But I think it's naivety or arrogance, because if you really understand what is happening and how fast it is changing, it is unprecedented change happening in unprecedented ways at an unprecedented pace. And when I hear people talk about the 2 years from now story, they speak to precedent. When you look back with the internet, you can't do that, guys. It's not the same. It's changing in ways we've never understood at speeds 10 times quicker than we've, like, 5 years is now 5 months, guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's like we're living in dog years.
Yeah. It's absolutely. Yeah. Did you see the release that just came out yesterday?
It's like the movie Her, right? It's real time. Yeah.
And what's even more bizarre is the project I was working on, Gemma, we were doing that without all of the power and energy that they have. And I could show you now something that you'd be like, that's basically what they showed, with a slightly less, you know, slightly less inflections, a few bits and pieces, but fundamentally, and we were literally saying we've created Her 2 weeks ago. And then he just dropped that. And I was like, oh, that's what we were doing, but like 25% to 50% better. I hate you. I will say one thing. I was just thinking, the one thing I will say about the future 2 years from now, and this I can say with a relative degree of confidence, because it's pretty vague. And that is that I think 2 years from now, there will be two types of businesses that exist. Businesses that have fully embraced artificial intelligence and those that have gone bust. That will be the two types. And I genuinely believe that. And if it's not 2 years, it's definitely four. You are not going to be in business and not leveraging AI 2 years from now. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Yeah. Like, it's as sad as it is, especially in the creative space, it is an inevitability. But if you treat the AI like a true companion, it can be an absolute accelerator to your creative ideas and the iterations. The speed at which you can create and iterate, it goes mm-hmm. up an order of magnitude.
Yeah, it's phenomenal already to see even just like apps like the LinkedIn app having like this little AI star yeah. under people's posts, and you can click on that and it'll build on the discussion, and that's just going to just amplify. So you're going there'll be a lot of it that'll be just so embedded in business that people will be caught asleep at the wheel kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is if you really dig, and most people don't, I have this theory that people don't dig because it's scary. Because if you really, really look in, I say it's the cave, it's like a cave and it says AI stuff. And people go, looks a bit dark and spooky in there. And they normally go in there and it's all a bit spooky and things are happening that feel like magic and it all feels a little bit weird. And it somehow it violates their humanity and it all feels a little bit weird. And they find something that it does shit. Like badly, they'll go, I asked it to write a poem and it was rubbish. And now yeah. I can leave this cave confident that I have proven that it is rubbish. And they leave the cave feeling all good about it. I'm like, bah, 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 bah. And you're like, no, you're scared. Go back in and brief it properly and it will do better than you could have ever imagined. And I think that is one of the big problems with it is that
yeah.
people aren't really connecting with it and really understanding that this thing's bouldering on as an intelligent as a human. And when they give it agency, which they're starting to, and you get these autonomous agents with voice and the ability to control a computer, the unfolding there or unraveling of what we understand knowledge workers in front of computers to be is going to be yeah. tremendous and not yeah. something that I think the majority of the public or business or Congress is really in connection with. And that, to me, is something I might like to get involved in to help people understand it because it's coming.
Simon, you have a former experience as a CEO. You're a husband. You're a father. Your identity wheel is wide, and I know that you've spent a lot of time at Cerros over the past many years. I'm sure you've learned a lot. That you've continuously compounded into developing into a better leader, a better person. Can you identify one single moment that is your favorite moment that you're holding on to, and maybe there's a lesson there that you're going to apply to what's next for Simon?
Yeah, I got a great example for you. So during the process of deciding that I was going to resign from the company that I founded, I went all the way through in my head psychologically to start to question. I was trying to strip my ego apart to get ready for what it was going to feel like to lose the identity, because I've only really been the CEO for, you know, here 14 years and 5 years at the agency before, so the best part of 20 years. And I was really wrestling with it and scared, right? Scared of what? Who am I if I'm not the CEO? Who the hell am I? I'm not the CEO, because I'm so used to just being a part. But oh yeah, you're the CEO guy. You know, look at this guy. Fucking ego, loved it. And yet I wasn't happy, so I had to step down. And the takeaway, I think the best takeaway is that my son, who's just turned 8, Lucas, I told him it was about 2 weeks ago when it was officially happening. And they knew, the kids knew I was considering this, because they knew I wasn't very happy in the end. And I said to Lucas, sitting on the couch, and I said to him, guess what? It's official. I'm not going to be the CEO anymore. I've decided not to stay as a CEO. I'm going to step down. Someone else is going to take over. And he looked at me and he said, Daddy, if you're not the CEO, what will you be? And I went, well, that, Lucas, is the big question. And he looked at me, I swear, and he said, well, Daddy, you'll be you. And you are a great dad. And aww. I was like, fuck. Oh. I was like, whoa. And it's so funny because I was like, oh, Lukey, give me a hug. And he, you know, we hug still. He loves me. And I give him a hug. And he was like, anyway, I'm going to go and play basketball in the garden, and just walked off.
A special moment.
No idea how profound that was, fella. So, yeah, I think that's the takeaway, Simon, is that I am more than the CEO title. You are more. And the founders and everybody that's listening, you know, we're more than that. We're human beings, and I'm gonna give myself some space. I'm not rushing, although I'm trying to just do that. I'm not. I'm getting getting wrapped up in new ideas all the time because my brain won't stop, but I'm trying to just breathe and see what comes next.
If you want to continue the conversation, share your thoughts, or suggest topics for future episodes, be sure to connect with us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and LinkedIn at PlayNCo, or visit playnco.com.
We hope you've enjoyed today's episode, and until next time, keep playing, keep designing, and keep pushing the boundaries of what's next. This is Play In Conversations, signing off.